home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen. Live from Hollywood, it's Rated LGBT Radio with your hosts, Garrett Miller and Rob Watson.
Good evening, good evening. You are listening to Rated LGBT Radio, and it is only Rob Watson, not Garrett Miller. Garrett is working. He's got some work commitments, so he is like our sort of ace and hole guest star that comes on every once in a while, and love to have him when he is on. Of course, last week we had a caller that I had to break it to her that Garrett plays for the Rated LGBT team, and that was quite a disappointment to her because she was part of his groupie fan base. And so anyway, but yeah, so best to Garrett wherever he is tonight. He would definitely love to be here. This is the kind of show tonight, and the guests that we have on are exactly the ones he loves to talk to. So I know he sends his regrets to that. So tonight we are going to delve into a couple of different topics, one of which being dance and the arts, and that's going to be quite interesting on radio since you can't see anything. So I think our guest, though, if there's anybody who can create dance for us through just our talking, it will be our special guest, Arcadian Broad, who is incredibly talented and already has quite a lot of accomplishments racked up in his very young life. And also tonight, adding commentary and flavor and actually is a big supporter of Arcadian is my good friend, journalist Brody Lebeck, who is supporting, is emotionally and behind Arcadian's projects and promoting them in a very big way. And so it was very fitting that we have Brody on. And with that, I will let Brody speak for himself. Brody, good evening.
Evening, Rob. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm not bad. Actually, I'm excited. I'm very, very excited. Arcadian is just one of these incredibly gifted and talented young people. He's just the nicest person. And he takes teasing from me relatively well, which is surprising.
Well, that's a requirement.
Yeah, to know me, you kind of have to put up with that. That's true. But no, you said it well. I am very much invested in this young man and his girlfriend and his ballet troupe, the Orlando Ballet Company. I want to give a shout out to them. They do an incredible job for the city of Orlando, Central Florida. And as a matter of fact, they are one of the top rated ballet companies in the United States, and with good reason. Their director is just incredible. And Arcadian is one of their, he's actually one of two principal dancers and one of their choreographers. And he did a show last year based on Beauty and the Beast that was incredible. And it's on YouTube, and Arcadian has a channel. So, you know, have your listeners go see that. It's just amazing. And Arcadian, I'll say this real quick. I met Arcadian in a roundabout way up until 2 years ago, as you know. I was a Washington, D.C. based member of the press corps and the White House press corps, and I had been invited to a nonprofit function at one of our theaters there in Washington, and Arcadian was one of the featured persons, and Jamie Lee Curtis, who I've met a couple of times, was also there, and I had talked to her briefly. But Arcadian, just the energy coming off of him was just amazing. And so I was curious. And so I did the YouTube Google thing. And he was a contestant on America's Got Talent. Anyone who knows me knows how much I love that show and Britain's Got Talent. I mean, I'm just obsessive compulsive about those shows. So I watched. And then I watched two performances. And on the second performance, my journalistic colleague, Piers Morgan, wasn't especially kind, and I happened to be watching Arcadian's face, and I'm like, I know that face. Not Arcadian specifically, but his facial expression. Right. And about probably three or four months. Yeah, it was his eye and his reaction to Pierce. And I'll say it right up front. I'll say it in front of Pierce. I'll say it behind Pierce's back. I'll say it anyway. Piers Morgan is a bully. And the way he approached Arcadian, he bullied him. In my humble opinion,
Brody,
that's
this
just
is
the way I looked at it.
Yeah, because Blog Talk is not on FCC, we can say it directly. Piers Morgan was an asshole on the show.
Yes, he was.
He was a complete jerk.
He was a
to
jerk
talk
to
a teenager the way he did was unacceptable.
Yeah.
He was an asshole.
Well,
okay, anyway, go on with your story.
Well, you and I are both parents. You actually have two very talented kids who are now Arcadian's age, or about a year older than Arcadian was at the time I saw him. Anyway, my editor, I was the D.C. bureau chief at the time for LGBTQ Nation magazine, and my editor and I were doing a series of stories on bullying, and unfortunately we'd had some suicides in the LGBTQI community amongst our youth, and I remembered that look on Arcadian's face, so I just did some poking around, and I decided, you know what, I want to interview this kid, and so I did, and that turned, it was supposed to only be a half hour, we did Skype. That half hour stretched out for an hour and a half, and I got to tell you, I had the best time. The kid was just freaking awesome. I'll let him tell you the story. But I was right about the look on his face when Pierce said what he said, and it turns out there was more to the story, but I'll let Mark tell that part of it. Anyway,
right.
So the story unfortunately never got published because Daryl had other pressing priorities, and then eventually I left LGBTQ Nation. And then as fate would have it, I tripped into Arcadian again on Facebook, and I put a request in, and I am so grateful because we reconnected, and we pretty much left off where we started with that Skype interview 2 or 3 years ago, and he asked me if I wouldn't mind, first he asked me if I knew anyone that could help him out a little bit with this project that I'll let him tell you all about, and if I wouldn't mind helping, and of course you know me, if I adopt one of these kids, I call them Brody's brats, and I consider him and his girlfriend Taylor now part of that collection. You know me, I'm just balls to the wall. Whatever I can do to help these kids out. Because I firmly am committed to paying it forward, but I'm a huge, huge fan of the performing arts. I've been a longtime supporter. While I was stationed in Washington, I was so fortunate to have been able to go virtually every year to the Kennedy Center Honors and cover that. I have been to the Kennedy Center for other productions on Broadway. I have seen some of ARC is actually an alumni of the Juilliard School in New York, and I've had a chance to go to Lincoln Center and see them. Anyway, the kid's incredibly talented. He's an incredible young person. Him and Taylor are just great. And he's got this project that he wants to do, and I'm fully committed and I'm fully vested in helping him realize his goal because I think Arcadian is going to be one of these people that, like Marushnikov, who I've met, we're going to be seeing and hearing about for a very long time. And I'm sure right about now he's turning red. I can actually visualize him right now on the other line, turning red, going, buddy, 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 buddy. So with that, I will let you play host and bring Ark on.
Okay, well, actually, I'm gonna razz you first before I bring Ark on. Because you are a great promoter of a lot of talented young people and everything else. And tonight you shared this wonderful picture, this adorable picture of Ark and his girlfriend and the cutest puppy in the world. I mean, you were a radio host dream from a PR standpoint with them out there and here they are. And isn't this great? Except you didn't mention the fact that we had a show at all. So, you know, you're fired. So whatever.
Okay. I also made Taylor, his girlfriend, laugh because Arcadian kind of laughed at me because of the description I used, and so I followed that comment of his up with another picture she'd posted of the dog in a fairly suggestive way, and I said, okay, so Arcadian, human companion, snark, i.e., what about this, you're going to draw me like one of your French girl Jack pictures?
Yeah, and we couldn't have worked in. And by the way, listen to Arcadian tonight on Blog Talk Radio. But if you and I keep going, we actually won't be hearing Arcadian tonight on Blog Talk.
Okay, well, no, you're talking Arcadian.
So without further ado, I'm going to bring Arcadian on. Ark, how are you tonight?
Hey guys, I am doing really good. I'm just laughing, like, trying not to laugh while I listening to you guys. So this is pretty funny.
Feel free to laugh. I have to tell you, I love your name. I mean, apart from all the other fantastic things you have going for you, I love your name, and you actually spelled it out in one document. And I'm going to give my own twist on it, that your name means living the simple life in the widest, biggest way possible. And I really think that is descriptive of what I've seen of your work and everything that you have going for you, because you go to the simple truths and the heart of things, but you put them out there in this broad, wonderful, artistic, fantastic way. So am I close?
I mean, yeah, I guess so. That's actually probably one of my favorite meanings that someone has given my name. that's like really, really deep and cool. But yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure you've hit the nail on the head there with that. In all my work, you could probably like paraphrase me when I'm teaching choreography or whatever to either my colleagues or some students or something. And I'm pretty sure I say these words where I'm like, whatever is the simplest way to get from here to here, but just do it bigger. So that's basically exactly what you said, which is kind of creepy. So
don't worry, I haven't been stalking you. I just do a lot of good research. So, there you go. So
yeah, well, nice.
So let's take you back, because you have this very unique situation where you have this huge background of a seasoned professional, and yet you are barely able to walk into a bar and order a drink for yourself. So, I mean, so how did you get started in dance? I know when you were on America's Got Talent, you talked about how you kind of found dance as a remedy for bullying, but was that your first introduction to dance at that point in your young life?
Well, no, I had come from a family of four other siblings, me being the fifth one. So we come from a big family, and my older sister, she was a professional ballet dancer. So I grew up like watching the professional shows. And then eventually my two younger sisters got into dance as well, like jazz and ballet and, some tap and all that good stuff. So I also went to like recitals of like little studios too. And my youngest sister, she's 6 years younger than me. And I ended up starting dance after she even started. So, it may sound kind of, corny and whatever, but the initial start of dance for me was I was at my little sister's recitals, and I ran into this guy there, and he was the only boy on stage amongst this like a sea of girls, and he was like on top of this table just like going crazy doing these like intense moves and everything to Guns N' Roses' Welcome to the Jungle. And so I saw him afterwards, and I was like, dude, that was like really cool and everything. Like, why? Like, I didn't know that you could like do stuff like that, because I was used to watching ballet, and I was not interested in ballet. It was too boring for me at the time. So he's like, yeah, it's really fun and everything. Is this, you should give it a try, you should go and take a class or something. And I was like, yeah, I just might. And he said, and even if you don't like it, look at it this way. He's like, it's better being in a room with sweaty girls and being on a field with sweaty dudes. So I was like, okay, I guess I'll roll with it.
I think that's the best
how
straight
started.
Boy. Yeah, I think that's the best straight boy rationalization for dance that I've ever heard.
Yep.
So
yep. It's your exact stereotype.
You're having me rethink my decision when I was young not to join the football team, because it's like, hey, these are the best looking guys in school, and I would have gotten to shower with them every day. So actually, you remind me so much of the stories of A Chorus Line. I mean, it's that I assume you've seen that show or familiar with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I am. I actually haven't watched it, but I have heard of it.
Oh, you've heard of it. Okay. All right. So now I feel old. How about you, Brody? Did that just age us like a thousand years?
I'm just going to I'm going to sit here very quietly and be a good person.
Yes. We just talked about ancient classic theater, this old show called A Chorus Line. So anyway, if you get a chance to see it, I think you will relate. But that show is about dancers, and it comes up from the beginnings of some really deep-seated needs that they had to break into this realm of the beautiful and find ways to express themselves that way because they were running from challenges in life. And I know you did experience some bullying. So what was bullying like, and how did that arc over into your dance?
Well, I mean, if we just go, down memory lane and go to where, before I even started dancing, and he looked at me, I was this, really small, really short, skinny, or super skinny, awkward kid who, I was always very respectful. My mom brought me up with, all the manners and stuff. Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. Please. Thank you. All that good stuff. And so I was always very quiet and always, only spoke when I was spoken to type deal. And I had a mushroom cut. I had a bowl cut for a haircut. So that was the icing on the cake. But I was never accepted amongst, the general populace of, the class or anything. That's just how it was. I don't know. And I was, slightly smarter. I was just different. I liked different things than other people. So that's just how it was.
And what was the people, the guys' reaction to you? I mean, were you accused of being gay for liking dance or any of those things?
Yeah,
being in a position where you would like dance?
Yeah, well, I was, like I said, I was bullied just for basically just being different at first. And then when I did start doing dance, then it was the whole being gay type thing. And, you're a pansy and you're a ballerino or twinkle toes and stuff like that. So, I mean, it's all your classic name calling and everything. That's when that initially came into play. And it was just funny because, even though, I was bullied beforehand and everything, and then I started dance, and then it got even worse. I fell in love with dance even more. It's almost like it didn't even matter anymore because dance for me was that important and that relieving in an emotional way. When I first started, that I just kept with it and wouldn't even care anymore about what, other people would say. And I think that, that's part of the magic of dance, especially for people who are, considered recreational. That's why they do it. They do it for the exercise, and then also it's an emotional release. And that's what it did for me in the beginning.
And can you, I'm going to ask you a really wild out there question. So just, gear down.
Okay.
because many gay men who have gotten into dance and gotten into that kind of expression have been bullied for that. And, in many cases, I think the people I know who I've talked to about that experience, they come to it in a way that they are expressing, they are not holding themselves back from expressing masculinity or femininity because inside they've kind of opened themselves up for that anyway. Now in your case where, and that's not to say that a straight guy wouldn't have, a feminine nature, because I think you do, but what can you say about masculinity and dance? Are the two compatible? Are they one and the same thing in your experience?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a difficult subject, but I'll do my best. So if we look at ballet in general, and you look at the way that ballet was created throughout history, it was created by guys. It was created by men. And back in France, King Louis XIV was the first person to create what we now know as ballet. And at that time in history, there was no women allowed. So there was men playing female roles or, you know, less masculine roles in order for the sake of story. And it wasn't until like maybe almost 100 years later where females were eventually allowed into the ballet and then, you know, they eventually took over. But if you look at every story in a ballet, like Swan Lake or, you know, Nutcracker, La Bayadere, all these big classic story ballets, it's all about this princess meeting a masculine prince and sweeping her off her feet and saving her from some evil sorcerer or whatever. And, you know, so the masculinity, like the total macho masculinity, is built in to these stories, which is why I've never really grasped the idea why people think that ballet isn't masculine or it's not athletic or anything. But it's literally written into the context of the technique and context of the stories, saying that the male characters have to be males. They have to be masculine and they have to be there to support the women to literally carry them through, not only physically or, you know, emotionally and through their character and stuff as well. And that's was built throughout classical ballet, and that has reigned true from all the way back then to current times, whenever these types of shows, those classic ballets are performed. And the cool thing about, you know, our progression and evolution as people is that when we created like modern and contemporary movement, that allowed us to play with the idea again of a guy being, you know, more feminine and whatever, or also a girl being more masculine. So like nowadays, it's very common to see in contemporary works, and even in my contemporary works, I do this as well all the time, where I have two guys partner with each other, or I have two girls or something. It's just, especially when two guys partner with each other, it has a completely different energy than a guy and a girl or two girls. It's just, there's so much energy that and so much power behind it that they can do things together that are really way more impressive than any other type of combination of a couple. And so it's just interesting how that plays out. And yeah, it literally, like nowadays when you get to have the opportunity to do that, it breaks the mold of the stereotypical, you know, ballet or dance is for girls type thing, especially having that knowledge that ballet was for men back then. The irony is just painful.
Yeah, exactly. I loved your answer to that question. I loved what you just said in every way. I actually observed that when I saw the tape of your very first entrance onto America's Got Talent. Because, you know, you had kind of one of those America's Got Talent experiences where you walked out, and I'm sure they didn't think you were, like, you know, talentless, like a lot of people have been treated when they walk on the stage that, you know, oh, gee, what are they going to show?
Right.
That thing. But you burst out with this incredible energy in your dance, and it was so disciplined and so really athletic, you know, in apart from the artistic measure that you were bringing to it as well. And of course, you wowed everybody. They jumped to their feet, you know, standing ovation, you know, well-deserved and all that. How did you lead up to that at 13 walking on that stage? That takes a lot of young guts. I don't think I could have done that at 13. How did you get there?
Well, you know, it's kind of funny how when you think about it, when I don't know if it was just me or if it's maybe just kind of that young ignorance or anything, that ignorance is bliss type thing, where, you know, at 13, or really, yeah, any of that young age, I don't think I understood the scope of everything, the gravity of it all, of this, that whole experience, or like what was about to happen once I step up there. You know, all I knew in my head and heart was that I'm going to go up there, I'm going to just dance for these few people, and I'm going to do what I've been working on for the past, you know, couple of months, and, you know, have fun. And then all of a sudden it just turns into something different, and it turns into this, you know, hoopla and phenomenon. And I distinctly remember, you know, later on in that whole experience when we got to the live shows, and I think it was the, you know, the semifinals, and I got there and I was, you know, I'm pretty sure one of the producers was like, oh, well, are you excited to, you know, are you nervous to perform in front of, you know, millions of people? There were like 15 million people or something. And I was like, oh, really? Like, that's how many we're doing? And I was like, that's how many are watching? I didn't even think about it. I just, all I saw was a couple of people that were in the studio and then the cameras. And I just did it, you know?
Right.
And
it,
as you get older,
it reminds me of the,
you realize.
It reminds me of the question somebody asked Jennifer Lawrence when she won her Academy Award. A reporter said, you know, well, now are you worried about that you peaked too early? And she looked at him, she was like, well, I am now. It's like, why do you say
exactly
things like that to a young artist? That, you know, it's like, let them stay in their bliss. You know, it's like, you know.
Uh-huh.
So,
yeah.
You know, very,
yeah, no, I try to keep that even now when I go on the stage, that, you know, youthful bliss, I guess.
Well, I think you have to, as, I mean, I do it on radio and, you know, I've spoken in front of very large crowds, which I'm amazingly comfortable doing. I'm more comfortable talking in front of like 1,000 people than I am talking to 3 people on a cocktail party, whatever reason that I just am. But, you know, I do look at that whole crowd as like one, you know, it's like it for whatever reason, that's just one entity for me. So Brody and I already beat up on him, so you don't need to, but, you know, he did something that I actually found damaging and hugely offensive, because you were standing there as this amazingly talented 13-year-old, and he didn't just, he was sort of like doing a personal attack, which was, could have been hugely damaging. What was going through your mind when he was doing that?
I just remember that, you know, that whole week leading up to it was very, very hectic, you know, and everything with those types of shows, it is, everything's very fast paced and everything. And, you know, you don't have much time to work on stuff and get things going. And I just remember sitting there, or standing there, really, and I was like, I don't even remember what I was thinking. I just remember thinking that I needed to, like, defend myself or something for some reason. And so, obviously, I did. And, yeah, maybe I wasn't, you know, the most politically correct when I opened my mouth, but, I mean, I didn't really think about that at the time. I just kind of said what I was feeling, and I felt like that I, you know, you know, maybe he was right that maybe I wasn't ready or something, but I felt that I did work hard for that particular moment, especially in that particular time frame and everything. So,
right.
You know, I guess something along those lines.
He wasn't right, and I was really glad that Sharon Osbourne saw it and shut him down big time, which was
yeah,
completely
very sweet.
Yeah. So you went from there and then Juilliard. How was the entrance to Juilliard? What was that experience like for you?
Oh man, well, I mean, Juilliard was amazing. Like I look at that as the moment of my, you know, artistic career's turning point. You know, that's where, that place was where I learned how to make my body do what I wanted it to do when I wanted it to do. It taught me how to choreograph and how to become a storyteller and it made me feel more connected with the human consciousness as well. You know, it's just something about the way that we would go from class to class and from style to style. We, you know, every day we went and danced in almost every single style throughout the day. It was really long days, and it was awesome. And by switching through all those different styles and different techniques, it exposed me to all these different people's ways of thinking and how they literally all thought the same thing. They just expressed it in a different way in order to get the same type of message across, which is they're trying to create beautifully aesthetic lines and shapes and everything. And then as the more modern we got, it became more of a personal expression of who that person was. And it became very evident that, you know, this person was Martha Graham, this person's movement was Lamone, and this person was Cunningham. It was very evident the more you worked on it and saw it. And that place just blew my mind up and expanded it and opened my eyes to the world of dance and what it is and what it can be and what it's meant to be.
And so, and I love that. And I think that experience is huge. And the fact that you were open to it and absorbed it was magnificent. What would you say, having learned that and looking at the value that you got from Juilliard, but if you turn to somebody who is coming from a different direction towards dance, like coming from the streets, that didn't have the Juilliard advantage, that they weren't able to go to a school like that, what lessons did you learn at Juilliard that you would turn and tell them in their life experience and their more, you know, street experience with dance that they should be looking at and focusing on to recreate that for themselves?
That's a good question.
That's my job.
the hard ones, right?
Yeah. I have to come up with the big questions.
Yeah. I mean, you know, a lot of people, they can kind of bash these types of, you know, art schools or whatever, saying, like, you know, when they say, so this one's from, you know, Juilliard, or this one's from Sunny Purchase, or this one, you know, stuff like that, and they're like, oh, them and their art school education type thing. And it's like, no, I mean, it's, yeah, you know, it's continued education, you know, higher learning or whatever in the arts. But when it comes down to it, that degree that you earn at the end of it, of those 4 years or whatever, it doesn't really do anything, you know. It just shows that you completed something. And the difference was, I feel like I would have learned whatever I learned there eventually, you know, but being there fast-tracked
right.
it.
Right.
So I think that people, you know, in this sort of street experience, they have this sort of kind of like instinctual raw connection to maybe what dance could be. And that has its own beautiful twist. And sometimes you can't teach that. So when you come across a dancer or a person who has that kind of raw vibe about them, sometimes it's refreshing. So I don't know. It's just kind of just finding that mix. And even with myself, I try to do that every day and keeping things fresh and, you know, taking my knowledge, but also making it feel like I'm learning stuff for the first time again. And, you know, that's kind of the challenge and fun of that game, I guess.
Right. Well, and I went to UCLA, so it's like I'm definitely not putting down, you know, the adventure of going through, you know, an institution like that of higher learning. For me, and I heard this in what you were saying about Juilliard, except I wasn't doing it in the dance milieu, I was doing it in other places. But for me, that education taught me how to think like other people. It's like I plugged into, mm-hmm. you know, how to think like a philosopher. This is how a philosopher breaks things down. Here's how a, you know, social scientist breaks things down. Here's how a biological scientist breaks things down to look at the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's like, and I heard that from your perspective, what you absorbed from the dance greats. And so anyway, I think it's
yeah,
really
exactly.
inspiring. So let's take you to Orlando. So you ended up in Orlando and have kind of grown with the troupe there. You've been there for about 6 years, is that right?
Yeah, I think come September it'll be the beginning of my sixth season.
So you've grown there, obviously. And Brody mentioned earlier that you were the creator, choreographer of everything of Beauty and the Beast. And I saw snippets of your work there. And I have to tell you, because, I read that you had done Beauty and the Beast. And it's like, oh, yeah, that's cool. That's a great idea. But then seeing the snippets, especially there was one scene where I'm pretty sure it's a scene where Beauty has been captured in the castle and he's putting her there or whatever. And it was so expressive and kind of, it was sad and emotional, but also kind of sensual. I mean, it was like there was a lot there that was an overlay to the story. How did you approach that in infusing dance over that story that is, tale as old as time? What was your approach?
I did not have a very clear picture of what I wanted to do or a clear thought when I was given the task to do a Beauty and the Beast show, a ballet per se. So obviously I did my research and everything. And then the first thing that comes up is Disney. And being here in Orlando, it's Disney everywhere. So
try to avoid it. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
That was a task, trying to avoid the commercialism of that while I was trying to make this and compose this ballet. That was rough. But I Googled all different versions of the story, the original French tale, the Brothers Grimm's tale. There's even this Japanese version of the tale. And I came to the realization that this story it's been a part of just our world since literally the dawn of time, because the idea of being able to love something that is either less than you or, more terrifying than you, and be able to look past the exterior and find that soft, lovable interior is, kind of like a genuine, superpower almost for whoever is beholding that, beautiful interior of this hardened person. And so that moral rings true in almost every story that is considered an epic love story. So what I did was I kept a lot of these, a lot of the characters that everyone knew, because we needed to have that likability factor. And then I kind of just added characters or took away some and, added some more highlights on the rose. For me, I felt like the rose was a, very important part to the story. I mean, that rose is literally Beast's lifeline, and it's also his stopwatch at the same time. So I always felt like there needed to be something, some connection more strong with that rose in him. And I also tried to give Gaston a little more of a background rather than just being this, macho dunce that comes in and just doesn't, know what he's doing half the time. And I just try to give each character a little bit more depth, but also poking fun at it, because, it is a fairy tale. So there are moments where you can poke fun at it. But the most difficult part for me was definitely the composing of the new score, because, you know how popular and catchy all those Alan Menken themes are. It's insane. I mean, the guy's a genius. Everything he writes turns into a freaking show tune. And it's insane. But so what eventually I ended up doing is whenever I would get stuck with certain things, because with ballet, you have to, not only does the movement have to be very clear, because you also have to, through pantomime, tell the story with your body because you can't use your words. But also something that helps that is making it feel like the music is talking as well. So you know, with the orchestra that I was writing for. I wanted to kind of think that each instrument was a voice of a character or something. And whenever we were in these scenes where every character was in there, like, you know, for instance, when Beast was attacked by the wolves by saving Belle or something, he's injured and she's trying to tend to his wounds. And they kind of get in a little, you know, finagle and bicker with each other. And so there's kind of this, these banters between certain instruments sounding like, you know, they're kind of fighting with each other in a, you know, playful way. And then there's these other ones that little chime in the back, like it's a little peanut gallery type thing. And so I try to create a score that if the listener was just sitting there with their eyes closed, not being able to see what's going on, they could tell that when the clarinet comes in, that's Lumiere, or when the Celeste comes in, that's Cogsworth and stuff like that. And they could hear the conversation that's happening just as much as if they were able to see the conversation.
That's fascinating. I have to tell you, I mean, you were talking about how my description of your name was unique and everything else. Your description of the tale of Beauty and the Beast was, you know, more profound than I've heard other people talk about it. So it's, I really love the depth that you gave to it. I want to go to your latest project, though, because you are embarking on something brand new where, I mean, you've already done it all on stage, but now you're having to produce the backstage, and you're launching your own production. And it's, you know, from A to B Series 1, and it is conglomeration of two of works that you developed before. And I love the verbiage of how you've described those works. I mean, it's actually, I think, going to be an incredible stage experience for people. So I've said enough about that. Now you tell us what that's about.
Thank you. I mean, it's very, very nice of you. But I've decided to start my own dance ensemble called From A to B. And, you know, it's kind of a little play on words because, you know, I like to think that I am very well-rounded with my knowledge of dance and theater and production and all that stuff and music. And so, you know, and someone would say, oh, you've got everything covered from A to Z type thing. But, you know, my name is Arcadian Broad, A, B, and even though those letters are right next to each other, I wanted to sound like it, you know, can almost encompass everything, trick them into thinking that it encompasses everything, but still being clever at the same time.
Right.
But yeah, so this first production that I want to do, and I'm actually going to kind of like talk about some info that I actually haven't, you know, really publicly announced at all. So this will be kind of cool. So the idea of this first show, I was actually just playing around with it before I got on the call with you, and I was thinking the name of this first show would be called Progress, and there would be the two pieces, the conglomerated two pieces that would consist of this show. And the first one is called White Noise, which is, I believe, the one you were talking about, because that one was that one's been done before. I think it was premiered here in Orlando back in 2014, and it when I made it, I was going through some stuff in my life where I, you know, was going through some tough times with my family and also just with my personal life and everything. And, you know, when I got into choreography, that's kind of like also was another outlet where I could take my stories and put it out there and put them on different people, and people wouldn't even know it's about me, you know, but I would feel satisfied afterwards. So that's another cool little thing. But White Noise is based on the idea that, you know, we as people, we hear things, but we don't listen. You know, we look at things, but we don't actually see them. You know, we become too, like, self-centered with our own busy lives that we don't just take a second to, like, smell the proverbial roses and everything. And it, eventually everything just becomes, like, white noise in our head. You know, we got to get from point A to point B, and, you know, there's who cares about what's in between? You just got to get there. And it kind of becomes a very cold and uncaring place. And so I tried to relate that in this piece, and in that piece it kind of ends with a more hopeful twist that maybe, you know, we could change that eventually. So that's the work that's already been done. And then for the second piece, I want to do a new work that'll be premiered. That would be from A to B's premiere work. And it's going to be called Rite of Passage. And it'll be set to Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, which is a monster of a orchestral piece. It's amazing, but it's like terrifying at the same time. And to me, when I hear that, there's obviously the storyline that's attached to it. That's been, you know, throughout the decades. But I want to me, I kind of want to retranslate it a little bit. And I wanted to highlight all the different types of relationships and that we have with people in this world, from like heterosexual to homosexual, marital, domestic violence, or like brotherly or sisterly, maternal type relationships. And started out from that innocence that we have when we're a child, and see how that becomes tainted by this cold world that, you know, we could have through that white noise mind frame, and see how it can either be affected by that or how we can overcome it and pass through that time and leave a better world for the next generation and progress through these hardships that, you know, we are actually going through in our real world. And, you know, in theater, we can kind of get away from all that and go to a different place. So this is the idea that, yeah, we're going through all of it, but we could always progress past it and leave a better place for the next generation.
Yeah, it's funny,
so that's
because
the idea behind that one.
Yeah, the and that was actually part of the one I was referring to, that I, reading your thoughts on that ahead of time, I was really impressed by kind of the simple profundity of it. And, you know, going back to the, you know, circling back to the description of your name, it was kind of reminded me of that. It was sort of like you've taken these simple concepts of life of, you know, the white noise, sort of like the smell of the roses, and, you know, notice the things that are already there, you know, and pulling them up and folding them over into the simplicity of how relationships form and the complexities and, you know, the differentiations that happen through that. And it's sort of like taking the simple life and putting it out there in the biggest, broadest way.
Yeah.
You know, so it's exactly it. Yeah, it felt very reflective of you as an artist and a person. So
yeah,
what are
I definitely.
Okay, keep going. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
No problem. I was just saying how that, you know, I think that it's important as an art, in order to be a successful artist on all scopes, I feel like the person really needs to know who they are, and in order to figure out, you know, who the other people are and who these characters that they're going to portray in their works. So I think by the way that you keep corresponding, you know, the what my name means to what my work is, I think we're on the right path here.
I'm going to interject for just a second here, because I absolutely agree with that. Arcadian had asked me to give him a hand with putting some things together. I got curious. I'm a journalist, you know, so shoot me. So I went and looked up the definition of his name. First, I did his first name. It's a noun. It's not often capitalized, and it's a person who lives a simple, quiet life. And my immediate reaction to that was, yeah, right. And then the second part of it was broad, which is an adjective. And the second definition of broad was covering a large number and wide scope of subjects or areas. And I kept thinking back to the interview that I did with Arcadian, and what has now developed into, you know, a community friendship with him, and how true that was. And it was like, okay, this is representative in more than one way, because I've watched what Arcadian has done on stage, and I have seen an absolute, and I'm a layperson, guys. I'm the ultimate. I sit in the front row with the popcorn and the Coke, okay? I have no clue what I'm watching. In fact, I've warned Arcadian I'm clueless, but I know what I enjoy. But yet I saw this definition, and I've seen it repeatedly in Arcadian's work, from, you know, the AGT performances, obviously, but in his more recent work and some of the things he did. And honestly, that was one of the things at that performance he did in D.C. that day that I found extremely compelling. So his name is absolutely an accurate assessment and representative of him, not only as a person, but as an artist. Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, no, I agree. And
right, thank you.
One thing that makes art profound is when you bring up a paradox. And I think that paradox is what is, and apart from the name, which is, you know, it's there, but it's in the description of the work and A to B and what you have planned. It's, you know, there's this paradox of people kind of going through lives and the choices they make and what they choose to absorb or not absorb, and the interactions that kind of naturally we're drawn towards. I mean, we're drawn towards our heterosexuality, our homosexuality, whatever we are. And then, you know, conflicts that can happen, you know, when two naturally being drawn people conflict or, you know, run into, you know, things that are counter to their own self-interest or whatever happens to happen. But yeah, mm-hmm. So I think it's, I'm really intrigued because of just how you described your process of working with Beauty and the Beast, which is an established story, and, you know, and you've gone deep on that, to taking it to this and how the dance will express something where you aren't constricted to a story that people already know, that you're creating that.
Mm-hmm.
So your dance
yeah.
can be original and expressive and everything involved with that. I want to
totally,
ask you guys
totally.
Though, because this is such a big endeavor, what are the challenges of getting this together, you know, from, you know, the raising money and, you know, getting it organized and all the back end non-artistic business stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that stuff is all fun and games too. Right. No, I mean, there's tons of challenges that go with it, and also, you know, like red tape that goes with it and stuff as well. You know, dance and arts are predominantly, you know, taken over by the nonprofit sector. So it's, you know, there's always the decision of whether you want to be a nonprofit organization, 501c3, and then, or being a for-profit. And, you know, it's just, you know, a decision you have to make. I think, you know, I'm eventually making the decision to do the nonprofit, just so much paperwork. So I would get through that eventually. But the main challenge at this point, because we kind of have everything conceptually down, I have my ensemble together. Right now, I think we have 10 people, including myself, because I'll perform in it as well. So we got that on board. I also have my crew. Have an awesome backstage manager who she's done all my shows with the Orlando Ballet. And so I was like, I have to have you. Same with my lighting designer. And so we got all of that. I also have a wardrobe director and all that good stuff. So costumes are set, and, you know, sets and scenery and stuff, if that's ever required, we'll have that done too. So basically the biggest thing is finding the budget for theater venue rentals, and also for traveling and the cost of touring, because we want to have the ambition to tour to different cities, because even though I'm very community oriented and I love Orlando, and I am so grateful for this community for supporting me and bringing me to where I am today, but I want to be able to expand that into other communities as well and share the joy that Orlando has given me to these other communities. I don't want to be, you know, selfish and just keep it here. So,
I don't want you to be selfish either. I want to see this thing at the Kennedy Center. Trust me.
Right.
Well, there you go.
So guys, we are down to our, believe it or not, our last 5 minutes of our hour long interview here.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. That's usually what people do on this show, is that it goes very fast. How can people get involved? How can they support this show?
Well, right now we actually just launched a Indiegogo campaign that's titled Bring From A to B to Life, because that's what you would be doing. And we're trying to raise $15,000, which is a very modest number. That's what I'm trying to do, is keep it very low in terms of theater scope, so that way we start small and have somewhere to progress to. and we have some really good like perks and stuff to give away, and we have t-shirts. So you have if you're local to the Orlando area, or if you'd like to hop a flight to get here, you are invited to a behind the scenes rehearsal. You get to have a chat with me. Also giving away ticket packages whenever those go on sale. They can find us on Indiegogo.com under that. Also my Facebook page and my Instagram, AB_AKA Boy Wonder, is my handle for that. And, just my name for Twitter and stuff. You can pretty much find all my info there. Oh, and my YouTube channel. My YouTube channel also is very informative with that stuff. Which is just my name. They can find whatever they need to there. And that's what we're trying to do, raise money for the theater rental costs and for touring.
Great. And Arcadian, what else is on your YouTube channel if people want to see snippets of your work? And I mean, how far back does that presentation go?
I think it goes pretty far back. I know there's some videos of me competing, like very throwback Thursday style, with like me competing in the American Dance Competition. I'm pretty sure I was like 12 or 13 and doing stuff like that. There's also like more recent, like my debut as Basilio and Don Quixote. I know there's segments of obviously Beauty and the Beast there. There's segments of my original choreography work. The full piece of my work Time, which was the piece that really started it all for my choreography. And I'm always adding new snippets each day. Like I'm actually going to be releasing a little segment of White Noise soon to get some excitement about that for From A to B. And I'm always posting little clippets of me working in the studio or something, and I even do some singing videos every once in a while, maybe a vlog. So it's pretty well versed.
Fantastic. You exercise all the talent I do not possess. So I'm
that
very,
makes,
very
that makes, that makes two of us. That makes two of us.
Yeah. I'll be sitting in the front row with the popcorn. And it's like, I don't drink the diet.
Yeah, you're right next to me, Rob. Yeah.
Yeah. There you go. So, yeah. Arcadian, what we have literally 2.5 minutes left. What have I not asked you that I should have asked?
Under the pressure, right? I don't know. I think we pretty much covered everything. I think I just also want everyone to know, since we are on LGBTQ radio, make it very clear that this project, especially From A to B, because I'm always around the gay community, and that's where a lot of my friends and colleagues are too. So they are very heavily endowed into this project, and they fully support what I'm doing, and that's why I kind of wanted to do a piece like that for that, and especially here in Orlando with the whole Pulse tragedy and everything. It's almost like a tribute to it, but not at the same time, because I don't want it to be like that, but it's more of a celebration type deal. It's very friendly in that respect, and I hope it brings a new light to the closed-minded end of the community.
Perfect.
But I think other than that, I think we got it all.
Yeah, perfect. Well, you ended it perfectly and took us out in a very wide-reaching way. We'll leave that analogy alone. So I want to thank you
there
both
you
for
go.
Joining us on Rated LGBT Radio tonight. Also, thanks for our listeners, listen to Out in Santa Cruz this Saturday night. You can hear that on www.ksco.com live streaming anywhere. Again, 7 p.m. on Saturday, we will be talking about religious schools and do they have the right to put anti-LGBT stuff in their manual because that's part of their dogma, or should people be standing up for the kids who are thrust into that position? So we will be talking to an actual local school that is doing that in our community in Santa Cruz, and we're going to discuss it. And you can never guess what my opinion is, but anyway, you need to listen and find out. So again, thank you, Brody, for your incredible experience, your incredible wisdom, your storytelling, and our Arcadian, you are so impressive. I can't wait to see your work, and I can't wait to get it out there, because I think it's going to be fantastic. And listen again next week.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.